Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kuf Lamed Bet Amud Bet, two lines from the bottom. Ha'ud Amar Lahu, person who says, Tilta Lebrat, V'tilta Lebrat, V'tilta Le'itat. One third goes to a daughter, one third goes to another daughter, and one third goes to the wife. So obviously here we're talking about a situation in which there are no male children, so the daughters are the rightful heirs to the Yerusha. So the two rightful heirs are the two daughters, but here he allocates one third to his wife. Shchiva chad mi b'nate. One of the daughters passed away. Savar Rapapi lemeimar. So Rapapi thought, in that case, lo shakla ela tilta. She only gets to take the one third that she was allocated. So this is a continuation of the situation, circumstances, in which the husband gifts a certain amount of property to his wife. In that process, also gifts other property, the remaining property to other individuals. And the wife, in some way, presided over this, what her exact contribution was, whether she was involved with it, whether she was sitting there when it happened, but she is a party to this in some way, as we saw in yesterday's daf. And in doing so, she is then mochelet on the shibud that she has on these other properties. Her ketubah entitles her to a right of collection from all the assets of the estate, all the assets of her husband. That's the way the ketubah developed. We know that there were different iterations of the ketubah until finally by Shimon ben Shetach, they put it together that she would have a lien across all the assets of the husband. But then, here in this circumstance, she allowed the assets to be distributed, and in doing so, we assume that she is mochelet, that she is waiving her right to that lien because she is receiving something, and her receipt of that then takes the place of the lien that she had. Now, in some cases, we saw earlier on in the situations that she received a large tract of property, or she received all of his property. So in that case, she was mochelet because it was to her advantage. She got much more than she would have gotten through the ketubah, so she's mochelet to shibud. But we saw in the latter cases, even in a case where it does not add up to the value of her ketubah, still she accepts that in lieu of her lien, not in lieu of payment, but in lieu of the lien. That means that if other assets come in later on, she's entitled to take from them. She has a lien on the new assets. She's just waiving the lien on anything from this time backwards, meaning that anything that's in the estate right now, she's waiving the lien to that. So she will get whatever she gets in this allocation to fill her ketubah. Anything that's in excess of that, she'll have to collect from either new assets or she'll lose it because she waived her lien. So this is a circumstance like that where the husband distributed all of his property. We assume here as a shchiv meirah, because as we saw yesterday, that if he's a bari, we don't know what the outcome is. There it's a teiku, because you don't know if a bari, does the woman there have a different mindset, because she believes that by a bari, he'll get more assets into the estate, and therefore she's not really worried about it. She's not mochelet, but she's not worried about it. Or do we say that he has the same din as a shchiv meirah, if she's involved in this process, or has knowledge of this process, and waives her rights to the lien, it's a waiving of the rights that has no retraction. So that's number one, that we do it, all the accumulated knowledge that we have from yesterday, as well as the fact that we know that we only assume that she's mochelet, where there's no other alternative to explain her behavior. Her behavior belies a b'echila of her lien, then we say that's what she did. We assume that's what she did. The other hand, if we can give an alternate reason for why she did this, then we'll assume that she didn't waive her rights, and she was waiting, she had other reasons to acquiesce over here, whether it was nachat ruach lebala, to make her husband happy, or she believed that she was going to end up in court anyway, so she'll deal with one piece in court, and then she'll deal with the rest in court later on. All of those are valid reasons for her not to say anything at the moment, even though she's not mochelet. In this circumstance, he distributed all his property, he gave a third of the property to each of his daughters, so that means that they got two-thirds of the property, and they were the entitled heirs to the property. She, the wife, got a third of the property as well. Now, if it fulfilled her ketubah, that would have been great. The only thing is, it doesn't fulfill the full value of her ketubah. So in doing or in accepting such an allocation, the wife there, without speaking up, in essence is mochelet on her shibud, on her lien, on the other two daughters. So that would mean that she only has a right to collect out of the property that she got. What happens is that one of those daughters, prior to the passing of the husband or the father here, passes away. So the father, as a Shechiv Meirah, is gifting the property. We'll see in a second what that means, gifting the property over here, since these are entitled Yorshim. So maybe it's not exactly called a gift. We'll see that in a minute. But he's distributing the property, and the wife was silent. She accepted how he distributed the property. And that means she's mochelet on 2/3 of the property. She's mochelet on her right to a lien on those areas of the property. And the 1/3 that she got will fulfill whatever it does of the ketubah. And in this case, we should have to assume that there are no more assets coming into the estate, because he's a shechiv meirah. This is the end of the line. And that's why we believe she's mochelet, because she doesn't have any view or thought, or mistaken thought, that she's going to get any other assets. So in that case, we would assume she got the 1/3 and that's it. But before the shechiv meirah passed away, one of the daughters passed away. And in the daughter passing away, having no heirs, the property returns to the father. So now the father got back 1/3 of the property that he had distributed because he had given it to one of the daughters, now returned to him. Rav Papa wants to assume here that the woman has no more rights in that property than she did before. She waived her lien on that property. She had the 1/3 that she was given, and that's it. She's not entitled to any more. That's what Rav Papa was thinking. Amalei Rav Kahana, ilu hador kani milo shakla. Wait a minute. If the husband or the father in this situation went ahead and bought and purchased new property, she would have a right to a lien on that new property because that wasn't included in her waiver. Because it's prospective purchase of property, and her lien will exist on that because that's what's written in the ketubah. The ketubah says, I have a lien on everything you own today plus everything you will own in the future. So here it's something that came in the future. So in a situation where he bought new property, she clearly have a lien on it. Hashtanami shakla. So do over here. When he gets the property back from the daughter, it's the equivalent of a new acquisition of property rights. Because it did move to the daughter. While it was in the hands of the daughter, she waived her lien. But now that it was disgorged from the daughter because she passed away, it's as if there's new property in the estate, and she will re-exert her lien. Even though it's the same property per se, it's not the same ownership as it was before. It changed hands. It went from the father to the daughter and from the daughter back to the father. It's the equivalent of the father acquiring property from a third party. It's as if there's new property in the estate. And her waiving of the original lien does not affect this property. And therefore, she now has a lien on an additional 1/3 of the estate. All right, so how the palginu the nichse, the itite olivne. This individual split the property that he had in the estate, 50% went to his wife, and 50% went to his children. That's how he distributed the property. But she'er chadikla, he left behind one palm tree that was not distributed to either party, which means that that dekel will then be subject to the regular rules of Yerusha. So here he's distributing all the property, 50% to his children, 50% to his wife. But there's a little piece left over. Savar avina lemeimar, Leitla elachad diklo. She only has a right of collection beyond the 50% of the property that she got. She only has a right of collection or lien against that dekel that remains, because there she didn't waive her rights, because that wasn't a part of the distribution that was made. And since she didn't waive her lien there, she has the property that she got plus a lien on that one dekel. Amalei Rav Yemar the Ravina, itleitla chad diklo, itleitla chad diklo nami leitla. Ella, migo de nachta ledikla, nachta nami lekula nichsai. So what he's saying is that you can't have it both ways. If she has a right to go after the palm tree, then she has a right to go after all the property in the estate, even the stuff that was distributed. Or the other way around, if she has no right to go after the distributed property, she has no right to go after the dekel. The reason being is that, again, if you believe that she, through her silence, is acquiescing to this distribution, then she has to accept the distribution as it is, which is she got the allocation for her ketubah, and that's all that was given to her for the ketubah. The part that went to the children is out of her reach now, and the dekel, which is going to be part of the Yerusha, is also out of her reach, because in essence, she got a payout on her ketubah. It didn't reach the full value of her ketubah, but she got a payout. He satisfied her enough that she was willing to waive the lien that she has in her ketubah. But he says, I don't think that's right. He only puts that as an example. He thinks the other way is right, which is that if you can go after that dekel, you can go after all the property. And that is because here you cannot attribute her silence to acquiescence. The reason that she's silent over here is because she doesn't know the value of that palm tree. She took a certain amount of property in her 50% of the allocation, But then there is other assets in the estate where her lien can be exerted. She's not an expert in the valuation of that. She needs to go to Beit Din now to get a valuation of the Dekel and find out how much more of her ketubah is outstanding. So she says, listen, I have to go to court anyway to deal with this Dekel and get it valued to take from there. Once I figure out what's left over, then I'll start to complain about what he gave to the children. But until we assess the value of the Dekel, I don't know what I need to complain about or not complain about. So therefore, her silence over here is not an indication of her accepting the status quo. Her silence here is a lack of knowledge or an inability to assess whether she does need to object or not need to object. And that's what the Rav Yemar is suggesting to Ravina, that you're incorrect in your assessment here that she has no rights to anything besides the Dekel, but rather she has rights to all the property. She did not waive her lien. This goes back to what we said before. It's only classified as a waiving of the lien if there's no other way to interpret her silence. Over here, you can interpret her silence to mean that I need to go to court, I need to find out more information. And therefore, her silence is not acquiescence, it's simply a deferral till she figures out what's going on in this case. Here we have a conclusion to this series of cases here, where we have a woman accepting distribution of assets. No matter how small a distribution that she accepts, she waives her lien on the entirety of the property because she's a party to the distribution. And being a party to the distribution, we assume that she is acquiescent to the distribution if she doesn't object to the distribution. So over here, the Rashbam gives a summary to everything that we've seen until now. So it's worthwhile just to run through it quickly so we understand. It's right across from the Hagota Bach. In the Gemara, there's a little dot in the middle of the Rashba there. He says, V'hashta shmainan micha ha'cha. Deshchimira kotev kol nechasav. Shemira who grants all of his property either through writing, or mechalek the banav bifnei ishto, or he distributes it in front of his wife while she's watching. The gamla natan karka koshu, and he gave her some allocation, whatever it is, any little amount. Bishatka, she is silent. Vlo ir ara, and she does not object in any way. Vuadin imkatav kol nechasav lacherim bifanha, or he gives away all of his property to someone else in front of her. Valakat of Karka Koshu. Again, he grants her some small amount of property. Kano, Shari Machla Lehen Shibuda. All these parties acquire the property free and clear without her lien on it because her silence in all these cases is an indication of acquiescence to waive her lien. Veloti Tof Mehen Kirav Nachman. And you won't be able to go after them afterwards to collect against those properties even though you had a lien that preceded the distribution of these properties. Her silence meant that she waived that lien. Because she allowed herself to be a party to this distribution, that she was present, or she was aware of it, that makes her a implied acquiescer to the distribution and a waiver of the lien that she had or the rights that she had to collect against these properties. It has to do with whether she is a party to the distribution, meaning that she is also a recipient. Loshna im banav, loshna im acherim. Doesn't matter who the other parties are that he's distributing to, as long as she gets some portion, some property, and she accepts that, that's it. That's only when he distributes all of his property, as we just saw now. Aval shi'er afilu dekel echad. If you leave behind any other assets that are not distributed as part of this distribution, then ukarka kosho shlo perish to me, migo the hadra adikla hadra v'nachton the mikveh mikulo nichsei. Since there she has a right to go after whatever asset was left over in a lien, she then by that right has a right to go after everything with the lien because v'lo machla mida. She didn't waive her lien over here. She didn't waive her rights over here because we assume the reason she's silent is because she doesn't know how much she needs to collect. Or whether she needs to upend this distribution, because whether it satisfies her ketubah or not. The dafka shekatav la karka koshu. It's only if he grants her a portion of property. Avaminata la mitaltalin, velo karka. If he hands her mitaltalin and not karka, we saw that yesterday where he distributed the property to all the heirs and he gave her rights to peirot. We said there that that's not a waiving of her rights to a lien. Because mitaltalin are different than karka. It has to be karka in order for her to waive the lien. Velo mikre shutav ben abanim, velo machla. In that case, she did not forgive her rights. Midei v'nachta kulu nechsei. She can go after all the property. Kedam Rav Nachman, metaltalei lo kamrinan. We don't see this with metaltalin. V'hani milei da'avda ktubata mihanu nechsei. And again, The Rashbam reiterates that she only lost her right to collect from this property, Shekot of Levanav, that was distributed. Avalim Hadar Batar Hachi Vikoni Nichsei Achrine. If after that point in time he goes ahead and acquires other property, Vafilu Mahanu Nichsei Atzman Shechilek Levanav, even the property that he distributed to a child, if one of the children, Chas V'Shalom, passes away and the father takes the property back because of that, or he buys it back from them, go back and collect from them mutar tubata, whatever residual she has in the collection of her tubah. Shekach katavla, because that's the language of the tubah, that you have a right to all assets today, as well as any assets that come in the future. So if she waived her right to certain assets, as soon as new assets appear, she has not waived her right to those new assets, even if they are recycled assets. B'davka shchiv meira. It's only true by a shchiv meira, because by a bari, we said we had this safek with regards to a bari, whether she really is mochelet on the shibud, or she's just relying on the fact that there will be new assets in the estate, and therefore she's not really mochelet on her shibud. She just doesn't feel there's a reason to complain because there'll be plenty of assets to come. And now we left with the teku. And therefore it's a safek. And when you have a safek in mamonot, the din is a motzi mechavero alav araya. And therefore the burden of proof would be on her to show that she was not mochelet in that case, in order to take the property away from the people that it was gifted to, and to show that she did not give up her rights to the lien, because that'd be the teku. So by a bari, we don't have any clarity, but by a shchiv meira, we do have clarity. In those circumstances where we deem her to have been waiving her rights to the liens, then she has no rights of collection on those assets anymore, unless, again, new assets show up, or unless the husband did distribute all of his assets. And therefore, her silence, again, cannot be deemed as acquiescence, but rather just awaiting. She needs to wait for a resolution before she can argue or needs to argue on the situation. So that's the summary that the Rashbam gives us on everything we saw in yesterday's daf through what we saw now. Now the Gemara is going to move to a slightly different issue that's here. It actually goes back to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that we passed in the halacha like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that a person can redistribute or reallocate his assets as long as he's doing it to the rightful heirs of the property. So if you have sons that are going to inherit, you can allocate the percentage that goes to each son, even though the Torah would have just said the Yerusha gets distributed evenly. Because of Ayah B'yom Hinchilo Ad Banav, the father is now empowered to allocate to the children as he pleases, as long as one of those the people he's distributing to are the rightful heirs min Torah to the assets. So on this, Amar Rav Huna, Shchiv Meira shekatav kol nechasav le'acher. Shchiv Meira that gave over or wrote all of his assets to another party. Ro'im imro uili orsho. We will take a look and see. Is he an inheritor of the property? Notlan mishum yirusha. Then he receives them as an inheritance. V'im lav notlan mishum matana. If not, then we assume that he got it as a matana. Now, a couple of qualifications over here, the first of which is when you write all nechasav, all of his property to an individual, we can't be speaking about his son, and we can't be speaking about his wife. Because that we already saw that Rav Shmuel told us that anybody who distributes all of his property to his wife or to a child, he's just appointing them as an apitropus. He's just appointing them as an executor of the estate, and not that he's really gifting them the property. He's doing it to get them the kavod or the proper standing that they should be given, but not because he's really gifting them all the property. So over here, it has to be a situation or a circumstance where his kotev kol nechasav is not to one of those parties that would be assumed to be an apitropos, rather to a party that would be a full recipient of the assets. So now he distributed the assets. We take a look. In that distribution, the recipient of the assets, is he the rightful heir to these assets? Meaning he would have been one of the parties that would have received it had he done nothing. And now when he allocates them all, it works, and he's a yoresh. Or do we say that he's not the primary inheritor, one of the primary inheritors? He is gaining the property as a matana. The Gemara in a second will discuss what's the difference if it's a Yerusha or a matana. But nevertheless, that's what Rav Huna said. Amar le Rav Nachman, so Rav Nachman said to him, Ganva gnuve lamalach. Why are you hiding in the shadows? Why are you not being explicit about what you're doing here? Is verolach Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. If you hold like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, ema halacha k'Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, then just come out in the open and say that you think the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, because that's what's happening over here. He's giving the property, and in giving the property, we're uncertain as to the mechanism for that giving of the property. Is it a Yerusha, or is it a matana? But belying that or underlying that is the fact that if he did give it to the person who was supposed to be the Yoresh, then that Yoresh would get it as Yerusha. How does that work? The only one who allows that to happen is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says you can distribute assets while you're alive, allocate them, and then when the Yerusha comes, it'll be allocated based on your dictate. That is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Otherwise, you have to say it's a matana. If you don't hold like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, then Yerusha always works by the prescription of the Torah. And it'll be evenly distributed amongst the primary Yorshim that are entitled to inherit over here. The fact that you could allocate it to a particular individual through Yerusha, that's the view of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So Rav Nachman says to him, why are you sneaking around saying this is either this or that? Just say explicitly that the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, because that's what you're doing in essence. Now, as the Rashbam points out over here, the circumstance of the situation that makes it ambiguous is the language that he used. There's certain languages, like the language of matana, which is that I'm granting to you, I'm giving to you, but you would know for sure it's a matana. There are also languages that are clearly Yerusha. I am bequeathing to you. I am morish to you. That would be clear as Yerusha. The circumstance over here, the situation over here is a case where he used language which is unclear. The ambiguity in the language, which he said, Nichsai lach, my property goes to you. So there he didn't use any verb. So we don't know what he meant. Did he mean to give it as a matana or Yerusha? That's why it's open to the discussion of whether it is Yerusha or a matana. And that will depend on the individual. Now, what we will say is, depending on the individual, we will always give precedence to Yerusha d'oraita, which is that when you have a Torah prescribed Yerusha, we'd much rather you go through that mechanism than you gift to avoid the Yerusha d'oraita. So therefore, in a situation where the person is a Yoresh, and according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, you could allocate it to him midoraita, that's what we're going to assume you did. We're assuming that you allowed the Torah prescription to go through based on Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's understanding of that. If, of course, the person's not a Yoresh, and the only way to get it to them is through a matana, we're going to assume that's what you did. You gave it as a matana. So we are interpreting your granting of this property or these assets, this estate to the individual in the way that we could possibly make it the best situation. The best situation would be that it follows the protocols of the Torah. If we can't do that, we'll assume that is a matana. But it derives from the fact that you used ambiguous terminology to grant it. By just saying nechsai lach, absent a verb indicating whether it's Yerusha or Matana, and that's why you have this fake that we need to determine. So Rav Nachman is bothered by the fact that he's just not coming out in the open and saying the locha is because Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Dash matateich ki Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka dazla. Because your whole decision tree that you are speaking about here definitely follows the position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, because that's the only way you can have a Yerusha that is distributed by a Shemera. Yerusha happens after death. You can't gift after death. The only way to have something function after death is through Yerusha. And the fact that you are allocating and calling it a Yerusha, that's Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. He says, Dilma. So Rabbi Nachman keeps speaking on behalf of Rav Huna and says, Dilma ki ha dekamart. Maybe the whole reason that you did this is not because this has anything to do with Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, but rather it came out of a situational case. It is case law, and you gave your psak in the case, irrespective, you weren't trying to indicate or not indicate Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. That was a derivative of the case. But the case was this. Daud Avakah Shachiv, there was this person who was a Shechiv Meira, who was on his deathbed. Ramrulay Nechsei Laman, said, where do you want your property to go? Where do you want your assets to go? Dilma Laplanyo, maybe you want to gift it to so-and-so. Vamar Lahu, and he responded to them, Ela Laman, who else is it going to go to? So he answered them not in saying that, give it to someone, or yes, but rather in this rhetorical question, which is, who else are you going to give it to? Vamart lan Allah, and you, Rav Huna, told us on that case, Imra oili yosho, notlan mishum Yerusha, that if he is ra'ui to be Yoresh, then we give it as Yerusha. Vimlav notlan mishum matana. And if not, he gets them because of a matana. Or in essence, what he's saying is that Rav Huna was saying that that is considered to be a distribution. Even though it wasn't said clearly or explicitly as in a distribution, from the context of the conversation, it's pretty clear that that's what he wanted to happen over here, is that he wanted there to be a distribution to this individual, and that's what we're going to carry out. Now, how we carry it out, it could be a Yerusha, it could be a Matana. From that, you wouldn't conclude, like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, but that was not the primary issue in the case. The primary issue in the case was, did he give the property to this individual or not? And Rav Huna is saying, yes, this is a giving of the property. Now, once you do that, you have to determine the mechanism by which he gave it. Is it Yerusha or Matanah? That's secondary. That secondary issue is where Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka comes up. That wasn't the primary reason that Rav Huna was telling over this information. It was a case that was the question of determining whether he really did give something or didn't give something. Rav Huna says he did give something. Now that he gave it, did he give it as Yerusha or did he give it as Matanah? And in that way, he is not really addressing Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, not, even though as an aside or a secondary item, we do figure out from that he paskins like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka because of the fact that he uses Yerusha as one of those mechanisms for the giving of the property. There are those who want to suggest here that the circumstance of the situation was that it was an individual where we didn't know their relationship to the bequeather. And then we figure out, he says, figure out whether this person is the closest of kin to this individual, and therefore they're going to get it anyway, because he passed away and they are the rightful heir to the property anyway. Or if they're not the first in line in terms of Yerusha, then it was given to them as a gift. And in that way, actually, it would not involve Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka whatsoever. Because then, when he says Yerusha, he literally means Yerusha, where you're the first in line. So that's what he's saying. If this person's first in line to collect anyway, then just let it go as Yerusha. If they're not first in line to collect, then you're going to have to give it as a matanah in order to carry out the divrei amet. And that way, actually, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka wouldn't be involved at all. Although, again, the first way we explained it is that it's simply a secondary or an outcome of his psak, that this is a giving, then you have to determine what type of giving it is. Amar lei, in halachat kamina, you're right, that's exactly what I meant. The mai hilchata, what is the halachic difference of whether it's a yerusha or a gift? This is what Rav Abba Bar Abba speculated in front of Rav Abba, that this is the reason. If it is Yerusha, the widow has a right of mizonot from those properties. On the other hand, if it is a gift, she doesn't have a right to collect mizonot from that asset. That is because in the ketubah it's written that the widow has a right to remain in the estate and eat mizonot as long as she is not taken by another man. And as long as she doesn't remarry, she has rights to stay in the estate and collect mizonot from the estate. But if she gets married or she collects her ketubah, that terminates her right to mizonot. Now that right to mizonot exists from the moment that the husband passes away until we have one of those two triggers, the collection of her ketubah or her marriage to another party. So then, in the meantime, she eats from the mizonot of the estate for an endless period of time. I mean, you have to go to your actuarial tables and figure out how long a person's going to normally live in these situations. But she's entitled to mizonot. There is a takanat chazal, it's really a takanat ashuk, to protect the marketplace, that mizonot ha'isha, and it's true by mizonot ha'banot as well, daughters who eat out of the estate, as well as a widow eats out of the estate, they are only allowed to collect minichasim b'nei chorin. They're only allowed to collect from free and clear property that still remains in the estate. They do not have the right to go after property that was traded or sold or encumbered in any way to another party. The reason being is that this is a claim that has no finite number to it. We don't know. She could eat for 1 year, she could eat for 20 years. So if you're a buyer of property from this individual, you want to be able to assess the risk that someone's going to come back and take your property or foreclose on the property that you bought in order to pay off his debts. So you can assess. If you have the numbers in front of you, you can make a determination of what the risk is and make a decision about what to pay for that risk. It's a high risk, you're going to lose the property, you're going to pay less. Low risk, you're going to lose the property, you'll pay more. But you can assess it. She has a ketubah, you can see what the value of the ketubah is. He has outstanding creditors, you can find out how much is owed to the creditors and make an assessment. But, mizonot ha'isha, there's no way for you to assess that up front, and that's going to make it impossible for people to buy property, because they'll never be able to assess the value of the liability that exists. And given that, they're not going to pay up for property. And even if you say they're going to do it, they're always going to discount the worst case. And that means that nobody's going to be able to sell property at a reasonable price. For that reason, the Chachamim say that they can't take from Nechasim Mishubadim. So now, that is exactly what the Nafkamina is according to Rav Adar Bava. If you receive the property as Yerusha, that remains free and clear property of the estate. And therefore, she's entitled to collect Mizonot out of that property. It is the estate that's being passed in Yerusha. and his estate that's passed in Yerusha, she has rights to collect her mizonot out of it. On the other hand, if it's a matana, it's a gift, that means that it happened before the death of the husband, he gifted it at his party. That means now it becomes property that's encumbered because it really belongs to this individual. And that means at the point of death, when the almana wants to come to collect, she's trying to go after property that's already belonging to someone else. It's not part of the free and clear assets of the estate. And she has no claim. She has no right to it. So that would be the difference, both for Mizonot Aisha and Mizonot Abanot. If it's a matana, they have no rights to it. If it's Yerusha, they do have rights to it. So it is a big nafkamina as to what you call this distribution of the asset. And again, like the Rishpam said earlier, we're going to favor calling the asset a Yerusha, because in that way you accomplish the din d'oraita of Yerusha. If you call it a gift, then you're avoiding Yerusha d'oraita, and we will be less likely to determine that. So our first choice will make it into Yerusha, and our second choice will make it into a matana. Even though for the recipient, it's actually better the other way around. If it's a matana, then they're protected from Mizonot Isha. Despite that fact, we're going to say that the Shechiv Mirah probably wants to carry out the Din HaTorah of Yerusha. So now you have to determine what it is. If it's possible to distribute it through Yerusha, according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that's what we're going to say you did. But then it will be called Yerusha. So if it's a person like his brother, that he gave it to one of his brothers over the other brothers that were entitled to it, then we're going to call it a Yerusha. If it's a third party who has no shaykhut to Yerusha, then we're going to have to call it a matana. So we're going to look at the circumstance to determine. But if he articulated clearly it's Yerusha or matana, then we have to abide by whatever he said. If it's Yerusha, then it's Yerusha. If it can work, it's Yerusha. And then if it's a matana, it'll be a matana. Here we have this ambiguous language is what's leading us to this question. Amalei Rava, Migra Garo. Wait a minute. It's worse off because of this? Hashta bi Yerusha deoraita. When it comes to Yerusha deoraita, amart almanato nizonit minichasav. There, the almana has a right to eat from the nichasim, from the property of the estate. Bematana derabonan lo kosh again. You're talking about a gift derabonan. Certainly so. This goes to the core of what Eshchem Meirah is allowed to do. Eshchem Meirah, in essence, has no power to do anything, because he can't create a kinyan at that time. He can't do anything that's going to be binding legally, because he's incapacitated in many ways. But the Chachamim gave him the rights or ability to distribute property in order to yishuv hadat, so that he should feel calm and collected and not be in a state of frenzy or difficulty at the time of his death. You want people to pass away in the most peaceful way possible. So the Chachamim empowered the Shechiv Meirah to distribute property, and we say it's ke ktuvim umisurim dami. It's as if it was written and distributed based on that. So that is the rights of a Shechiv Meirah. But midoraita, these rights don't exist. Midoraita, the property should really go to Yerusha. And that's the only thing that happens here, because he didn't distribute the property. He didn't gift the property in a proper manner with the kinyan. He just did it through a dictate of speaking his will. In doing so, then we allow him, midrabanan, to do this. What Rava is responding to, Rava de Bava, is saying that in this situation, why would you say that deoraita, that it would make it that the woman has the rights to these items? But midrabanan, we're not going to let her have those rights. You can't say that this institution, derabanan, weakened the rights of the woman in this case. The institution, derabanan, is just to make the mate feel good. But that's all it's going to do. It's not going to somehow diminish the rights of the parties that are here. And that's what Rava says. When it comes to an almana, if deoraita was passed as Yerusha, she'd still have rights to collect her mizonot. Over here, where the Rabbanan empowered the Shechiv Meirah to make some sort of allocations or distributions, that's not going to hurt her rights here. That's not going to diminish her rights. They gave him rights so that he feels good and he feels calm and he's peaceful and he's going to his death. But that doesn't mean they took away the rights of the almana. And therefore, her rights should supersede these matanot. And that means that anything distributed as a Shechiv Meirah will still be subject to the lien that she has for mizonot. Because here, we're not talking about people purchasing property. We're not talking about people who are going to be somehow hurt monetarily by the mizonot Aisha. Because mizonot Aisha existed or pre-existed, and they're just getting a distribution of property over here. They come with that lien on it. And that's it. They're not paying for it. They're getting it distributed to them. And her rights are not going to be diminished by the fact that the Chachamim empowered him to distribute midrabanan. El Amar Rava, the answer as to what the nafkamina is, k'deshalach Ravacha bar Rav Avya, the divrei Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, nechsai lecha, vacharecha lepnoni, My property is granted to you, and after you, it'll go to so-and-so. So this is what we call a remainder trust or remainder will, which is that you grant the property to whomever it is, and then if they have remaining assets that you gave to them when they pass away, it'll go to the next in line to inherit. So you're setting this up as a waterfall inheritance by which you distribute the property to so-and-so, and then after they pass away, it'll pass to the next person that you dictate in this gift. Imaya Rishon Ra'oi Liyorsho, if the first party is a rightful heir, Ein L'Sheni B'Makom Rishon Klom, then the remaining party, number two in line here, will get absolutely nothing. She'en L'Shon Matana, Elo L'Shon Yerusha. Because you can't use a matana to distribute something to a person who is a rightful heir. V'Yerusha Ein La Hefsek. And when it comes to Yerusha, Yerusha has no stopping. The reason being is that once a person has property, they always have a Yoresh, with the exception of a Ger. Everybody has a Yoresh, and if you go all the way back up to the Shvatim, somewhere along the way, you got to find a relative that you have that gets you back to the Shvatim, as we said before. And therefore, if you are a person who's receiving something as Yerusha, there will always be somebody behind you to pick up Yerusha or to step into your shoes. That means that you never give up the property. Even if you pass away, the person who you bequeath to will then step into your shoes and be the Yoresh. If that's the case, then there's nothing left over for the next party. On the other hand, if it's a matana, then there will be a remaining trust, or like a remainder trust, a remainder will here, by which whatever the matana is left over will go to the second party. So that's what Rava says is the nafkamina. The nafkamina is if you came into the property as Yerusha, then if the Shechid Meirah had indicated that after you it should go to someone else, those words will be meaningless because he doesn't have the right to upend Yerusha. Once Yerusha happens, that Yerusha is permanent because anybody who you bequeath to will become the Yoresh in essence or stamp into your shoes as the Yoresh. On the other hand, if it's gifted to you, then the gift is done al tnai. It's done on a condition. The conditions have to be carried out. If you fail to carry out the conditions, the gift is null and void. So that means if there is remaining assets after it was gifted to you, you must give it to the next party. If you don't give the next party, then your gift was invalid because you didn't carry out the instructions of the individual. On the other hand, if you have a condition in the Yerusha, that's matneh mashakotu b'Torah. That's someone trying to change the Torah, trying to create a condition that goes against the Torah, and that fails. And that's what the Rishbam says. You have a matneh mashakotu b'Torah fails because you can't upend Yerusha. You can't decide how Yerusha works. Once something is Yerusha, there are rules of how it works. It goes to that party, and then there are other Yerushim after them. And those are the rules of the game. You can't reallocate or redistribute it as you please. The other hand, if it's a matana, you have that right to create the tanai, and they have to abide by the conditions of your gift. So I would say it's the difference between a trust, where if you set up a trust, you can determine how it works, because everything in the trust is gifted, and therefore you can set the rules of the gift. On the other hand, if it's done as a will, by which Yerusha is going to take place here, then that Yerusha, once it happens, is binding, and anything you say about the Yerusha after the point of Yerusha is meaningless because the Torah tells you what happens and you can't tell the Torah what happens to that Yerusha. That's the way the Rishbam reads it. Others just simply say that, not that it's matneh mashakotuv b'Torah, but just that there is nothing to speak about. There is no remainder to the second party because the first party always will be a Yoresh and anybody who steps into their shoes will be a Yoresh in that case. Whereas by matana, there will be something left over to speak about. That's basically what Rava says. It's Yerusha, you forfeit control to the Torah, and therefore you can't do anything about the next stage afterwards. You can't dictate. If it's a matana, then it's a trust or it's a gift, then you can control how it works, because you're setting the terms of the gift. All right. Amalei Rovel Rav Nachman, va ifsika. Wait a minute. But didn't he stop it? This individual said that I want the property to go to so-and-so, but I want that Yerusha to terminate at that point in time. He's setting a limit to the Yerusha that he's giving. Hu savar yesh lehefsek, Rachman amar in lehefsek. So what Rav Nachman says back to me is, yeah, he thought he could do it. The Torah tells you, you can't do it. I mean that when you're in the world of Yerusha, he thought he still controlled what happens to the asset. On the other hand, the Torah says, once it's Yerusha, it's out of your control. If it's out of your control, the Torah will dictate what happens, not you. And that's exactly what's happening here. How damarle the chabre, nichsay lach, vacharach liploni. My property all goes to you, and after you to so-and-so. Virishon ra'ui liyorsho. And the first individual was a proper heir. Had he said nothing, this individual would be one of the inheritors. So in his reallocation, based on Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha, he was able to reallocate 100% to this individual as a Yoresh. Shchiv Rishon, Atasheni Katova. The first guy, the first inheritor here, passed away. Number two on the list in the remainder trust says, I want to come and collect what belongs to me. Sava Rav Ilish Kameh Rava. Rav Ilish was in front of Rava. So here we have a number of generations. You have Rav Nachman, then you have Rava, and then you have Rav Ilish over here. So Rav Ilish is a Talmud of Rava. And Rava himself had questioned his Rebbe, Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman clarified for him that once it goes into Yerusha, you have no control over it anymore. So Rav Ilish is faced with exactly this case. And Rava was present at the time. Rav Ilish thought, Lameimar, Sheni Nami Shokyum, that the second guy gets it. Like Rava had thought earlier, but to say to Rav Nachman, that you still have control over it. Amalei, Dayane, Dechatzatzta, Hachi Dayene. These types of Dayanim, now Chatzatzta, the way that the Rishbam reads it means, Chotzeitz, or Chatzaya means to split it in half. Dayanim that do everything by pshara, they do everything by compromise, because they don't know how to give a psak halacha. They don't know what the right psak is. So how do they deal with all problems? Pshara, let's figure out some compromise over here. So that's the way that Dayanim who just compromise, don't know the halacha, that's how they deal with it. I mean, that's an improper conclusion that you're coming to. Or the way that the Rabbeinu Chananel explains it is, Chatzatzta Beit HaKvarot. This is the equivalent of Dayanim of Beit HaKvarot, which means that basically they're dead. Dead people can't dictate or can't say the right halacha. And that means that these are like Dayanim who don't know what they're saying, who don't know how to give a psak halacha. He's basically indicating to him there was a wrong psak halacha. Lav hainu d'shalach Rav Acha bar Rav Avia. This is the case of what Rav Acha bar Avia sent, which is that's the nafkamina between a Yoresh and a Matana, is that the Yoresh ends the line and there's nobody after them. Whereas a Matana, you can have these remainder trusts. And this is exactly the case, and therefore you can't give it to number two, because number one was a rightful heir, and that ends the distribution of whatever was happening here. Ichsif, he was embarrassed. Rav Ilish is embarrassed. Kari alei, ani Hashem, bi'ita achishena. So Rava says back to console him, ani Hashem, I'm Hashem, bi'ita in its time, achishena, I will speed it up. It's a pasuk in Yeshayahu, which is somewhat cryptic. Chazal darshan about this pasuk, that is the way that Mashiach will come. Ani Hashem, bi'ita. Bi'ita means in its time. That means that there is a fixed time by which Mashiach will come. There's a fixed protocol or plan by which Mashiach will come, irrespective of the behavior of the individuals, irrespective of whatever is happening in the world. The world will move in that direction, irrespective of the zichuyot of the world. On the other hand, achishena, there is a chance that you could speed it up. If you act properly and you do the right things, you can actually speed up the process of redemption. So that's the way Chazal learned it, that there are two types of redemptions. They run in parallel. There's a redemption that is running because Hashem has a clock or has a schedule for the world. But there's also an ability, achishena, to speed it up through the zchuyot of the individuals. That's the drasha of Chazal on the pasuk. Rava uses this to console Rav Ilish, who's embarrassed by the fact that Rava had to correct them in a din. The way that Rashbam reads it is that he's embarrassed now because Rava was here this time to stop him from doing the wrong thing. But that Rava might think, and that's what he was embarrassed about, that Rav Ilish makes mistakes all the time. Just Rava's not around to correct him or to fix him in those cases. So Rav Ilish is embarrassed by the fact that maybe Rava now thinks that he's an inadequate judge and that he is not the proper person to giving psak halacha, because here Rava showed up this time and found a mistake. Had Rava been here other times, he would have found more mistakes. Rava's then consolation to him is, Ani Hashem b'itach ishena. Hashem brings people at the right time. Hashem ferried me in here to be here at this moment when you needed that help. Generally, all your piskei halacha are just fine. Hashem at this moment knew that you needed help here, and that's why I'm here. That's why I ended up here at this moment, at this time, in this psak, because you needed help. And Hashem makes sure to bring in the help when it's needed. So that's what it means over here. That's his consolation to him. Don't worry. I trust you. I think you're a good posek. And just now, God sometimes brings in the right people at the right time to make sure you don't make mistakes. The other hand, if you look in the Misorat HaShas, he brings from the Oruch an alternate pshat, which is, Adayin lo higata lo ra'ah, bi'ita timtzeno. You're still a young whippersnapper. And sometimes when you're young, a Kadosh Baruch Hu makes it that even though you have all the knowledge and all the capacity to do it, you still don't come out with the right psak, because you haven't reached the age, you haven't reached the time period where you are ra'oi lahora'ah. Once you're ra'oi lahora'ah, you get a siyata dishmaya that helps you out. So you're still young now, you're still in the early stages before the point of hora'ah, and therefore Hashem's going to make it that you're either going to make mistakes, you're not going to come to the right conclusion, you don't have that siyata dishmaya, and that's why I'm fixing it here or correcting you here. But once you reach that point that you're ra'oi lahora'ah, then you'll be on your own and you'll be able to do it, and don't worry now that you have these problems or these mistakes that you're making. That's why you do shimush. That's why when you're younger, you're not a moreh hora'ah. You have to wait until you reach the right age. So that's the other possibility as to how Rava was consoling him. All right, next Mishnah. Hakudevet nechasav la'acherim. Person who writes away, gives away all of his property to others. Ve'niach et banav. And he leaves his children penniless, leaves them without any yerusha. Mashasasui. Whatever he did is done because he has a right to do such. It was a gift that was given away, and that's right. He has a right to do that. Ela einu ha-chachamim nochal menu. On the other hand, the chachamim are not pleased with his behavior, meaning that he is upsetting the chachamim. The chachamim look askance or negatively on someone who does this or acts in this way. Shimon Gamliel omer, im lo ayu banav noagim kishura, if his children were not well behaved, meaning that they're not following the ways of Torah, they are not upholding the morals and the standards of the family, then zachor letov, then he does the right thing. They should be penalized for the fact that they're not acting in a proper manner, or that they are not carrying on the torch of the Mesorah. And so therefore they deserve to be disinherited because of that behavior. Ibailu, mi plige rabbonon aleid Rabbi Shimon Gamliel lo. Is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's statement a continuation of the Tanakhama's statement? And he's just saying, it's not always that the Chachamim are not pleased. There are times that the Chachamim might be pleased. And that's, he's explaining, the Chachamim agree to this. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is just simply telling us that the Chachamim's statement is not a complete statement. Or, is he arguing that the Chachamim believe that it's never right to do this? Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says sometimes it is right to do this. So we want to know, is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel considered to be the Rabbim over here? He's saying what the Chachamim would have said. Or is he considered to be a dat yachid that is arguing on the Chachamim? The truth is, it shouldn't make a difference, because Rabbi Yochanan says in other places that any time Rabbi Shimon Gamliel appears in a Mishnah, the locha kimoto, the locha is like him. But what you see from here, and the Rashbam points this out, is that when the Gemara gives you an exception, that means that the Gemara is arguing on those klalim. Those klalim apply unless you have evidence from the Gemara to the contrary. So in this case, if we would come up and assume that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is a single opinion and not following the Chachamim, then according to the way the Gemara is reading, that would mean we would not paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, otherwise there'd be no nafkamina as to whether the Chachamim did hold like him or didn't hold like him. The fact that they're asking the question means there must be a nafkamina. If there is a nafkamina, that means the halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, despite the principle that we have in general, that halacha Rabbi Shimon Gamliel b'mishnah. Tashma. The Yosef ben Yoezer, Hayalu ben, Shoeno Kushura. Yosef ben Yoezer, the first of the Zugot, we just read it in Pirkei Avot, Perek Aleph, this Shabbat, that the first of the Zugot were Yosef ben Yoezer and Yosef ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim, they're also mentioned in the last Perek of Ketubot. But Yosef ben Yoezer, it was the Nasi of that pair of individuals, and it was known as a very righteous individual, a righteous Kohen, who was very makpid on the issues of Tuma and Tahara, and was later in his life killed, Al Kiddush Hashem, by the Mityavnim, who took over in Yerushalayim, and had him killed out for his obstinate views in being Jewish and religious. So here, he had a son that was not behaving necessarily in the best manner, or not following the ways of his father. Havale Elita de Dinare. Now, elita usually means an aliyah, an attic full. So here it could mean an attic full of dinarim, an attic full of coins, silver coins, dinarim. Kam aktisha. He went ahead and he was makdishit l'shamayim, he gave it to hekdesh. The Rabbeinu Tam, if you look in the first Tosafot, says that he doesn't think that the meaning of elita over here means an attic, and it's a derech guzma. It's an exaggeration, saying he had a ton of money, he had a whole attic full of money. Rather, he thinks that elita over here does not mean an attic, but rather a pitcher or some sort of decanter that they use to pour wine or oil. That's what it's speaking about here. So it's not an attic full, but literally like a pitcher full, but it was a large sum of money. And because his son was not acting in a proper manner, he wanted to have the money go to Hekdesh rather than to his son. Azil, his son went, Nosiv Bat Gadil Klile de Yanai Malka, or the other Girsa you can see here in the Bet is Gadel, which is the word Gadil means to weave. And that's actually what this individual was. They were the weaver of Klile, the crown of Yanai Malka, of Yanai the king. So this was the crown maker for the king Yanai. So the son of Yosef ben Ezer married the daughter of the crown maker of Yanai HaMelech. Olida Debitu, his wife gave birth. The wife of Yosef ben Ezer's son gave birth. Zavin La Benita, he purchased for her a fish. Kara, he opened it up. It was filleting the fish. When he opened it up, Ashkaba Margalito, he found inside of it a jewel of some sort, a diamond inside of it. It's very reminiscent of the story of Yosef Mokir Shabto that we have in the Gemara in Shabbat. Also that he was Mokir Shabbat and he ended up with this Margalito inside the fish. Amrale, so his wife says to him, Lo Timtaya the Malka, don't take it to the king to assess the value of this jewel or have him buy it off of you. Obviously, it was an extremely expensive and rare item that he found. So there are only a few people who can afford to pay for it. One of them would be the king. Now, her father works for the king in making his crowns. And she knows that if you show up with this jewel to the king, they're going to undervalue it. Or they're basically going to say, nobody's going to buy it. We're only going to pay you a small amount of money. You're not going to get a fair assessment of the jewel here for the use in the crown. The Shakli La Minach B'Demei Klile, because they're going to buy it off of you for a very cheap price. And the truth is that you probably won't have a choice about it, because once the king gets wind of the fact that you have it and he wants it, he's going to dictate the price and he's going to force you to sell it to him at that price. So don't go to them to get the assessment. Zil Amte the Gabe Gizbare. Go to the Hekdesh and ask the treasurers of Hekdesh to give you an assessment of the value. So here, even though seemingly these individuals were not so religious and not so strongly connected like the son of Yosef ben Yoezer, nevertheless, they knew that the treasurers of Hekdesh were honest people, Yirei Shamayim, and they would give you a fair assessment of what the item was worth. Why would they care about it? They need it for the Choshen and the Ephod. To make the Big Day Kahuna Gedolah, they need these precious stones to put in there. So even though the Urim Betumim was Batel and Bayit Sheni, nevertheless, you need the 8 garments of the Kohen Gadol. And one of those garments is the Choshen and the Ephod. They require a jewel that be placed in them. So they are interested in buying that. And similar to the story in Kiddushin with the Dama Benetina, gave Kibbut Av Ein by not waking up his father. He wanted to sell him a jewel. He didn't want to wake up his father. In the subsequent year, they had a Parah Adumah to make up for it. The Gemara in Kiddushin about Kibbut Av Ein. So we know that Hekdesh was interested in buying these jewels. We have it in that story in Kiddushin by the case of Kibbut Av Ein. And we have it here as well. But don't you suggest the price? Because we have a rule that when you dictate something to Hekdesh, you make a neder to Hekdesh, you don't need a kinyan. Your verbalization or articulation of it is the equivalent as if you have gone through with it and there's a kinyan on it. So if you dictate the price and they don't say anything, even if you are under-assessing it, you have to sell it to them at that price. So you don't articulate a price, because that will bind you to sell it to them at that price. Let them dictate the price. Now, whether she was right about what she's saying here or not is a discussion amongst the Mishonim. You can see it in the Tosafot as well. He differentiates between different cases where your articulation is binding or not binding with regards to Hekdesh, but generally it's only binding when you intend to give it to Hekdesh. When you intend to grant it to Hekdesh, then it'll be binding. On the other hand, if you're simply trying to work out pricing with them and you suggest pricing, that's not a binding price until you have a kinyan or you have some sort of form of acceptance of the price that is being spoken about. Then Tosafot turns it, if you are selling something shaveh b'shaveh on equal footing for its real value or its real price, over there's no binding to your statement because you're not giving anything to Hekdesh. You're selling it to Hekdesh at a fair price. On the other hand, if you are going to give a portion of what you really own here to Hekdesh, that amira will be kemisira dami, or that will be like a neder that you will be bound by. So it depends on how the transaction is structured as to whether it is binding on you because you're gifting a portion of the true value to Hekdesh, or whether it is simply a transaction that is not binding by amira because you are intending to trade it for fair value. So now, Ella, l'shaymuah inhu, let them assess it. Amte, he took it to the Gizbarim of Ekdesh. Shamua b'tleisare aliyata didinare. They assessed the value at 13, either attics full of coins, or like the Rebbeinu Tam says, 13 pitchers or buckets or decanters full of coins. Amrile sheva ika shitleka. Says that Hekdesh said to him, listen, we have 7 of those. We don't have the other 6. We'll tell you the price is 13, but we can't make the price because we don't have sufficient money to pay for it. We can pay for 7 out of the 13, but we can't pay for the full 13 that the asking price would be for this. Amrilehu, so he said back to them, sheva havuli, give me the 7. Shit harien mikudashet l'shamayim. The other 6, I'm donating to Hekdesh. So you'll buy it at a discount, basically. The price is 13. You buy it at 7/13 of the price. I'll take the money for that. It's enough for me. I'm donating the other 6 to you, and you won't have to pay for it. That's what he says. Amdu v'kotvu. They went out and they wrote down. Yosef ben Yoezer yiknis achat. Yosef ben Yoezer brought 1 elita worth of coins. Ubno yiknis sheish. And his son brought 6. His son's even better than the father. Now over here, the Rashbam discusses where did they write this down. Was this simply just written in the ledger? They had a general ledger that they kept for all the donations and to keep the accounting of Hekdesh. And that's what they did. They wrote it down there just to identify how the money came to them and what was being done over here. Or was this like the scroll of honor where people who made large donations to the Mikdash were written down in order to encourage others to make those donations? So maybe that's what they're discussing over here, that they wrote, Yosef ben Ezra gave 1, but his son gave 6. Look how good his son is. Encourage others to give donations to the Mikdash or to be a zikaron for those that gave to the Mikdash. V'igad Amre, there's some who say this is the way that the story went. Yosef ben Yoezer yichnis achat. Yosef ben Yoezer put 1 pile of coins, 1 pitcher of coins in. Ubno utzi sheva, and his son took 7 out. Question, if you look at it as the glass half full, the glass half empty. Do we look at the 6 that he donated, or do we look at the 7 that he took from Hekdesh? So now the Gemara says, midik Amre yichnis. So in the first version of the story, where it says that his son gave money to Hekdesh, Michlal de Shapir Avod, that means that what Yosef ben Yoezer did by disinheriting his son was good. Because look at the end result. He gave the money to Hekdesh, and the end result was that his son gave even more money to Hekdesh. So his disinheriting his son resulted in a good outcome, which was his son was even more generous to Hekdesh than he was. Adarabo, Midgamre Hotzi, Michlal de Lav Shapir Avod. Whoa, if you use the second version of the story, which says that Yosef ben Yoezer gave 1 pitcher and his son took out 7, that reflects negatively on the child that he took too much money for Hekdesh. He was basically emptying Hekdesh out completely. He was leaving them with no money in the treasury. That's a negative statement. In that case, it would be a condemnation of the action of Yosef ben Yoezer. See what he did? He gave all the money to Hekdesh, and then the result of that is his son drained Hekdesh of all the money that it had. So his son, it was a negative outcome, and it wasn't right what he did when he disinherited his son. So here you have 2 versions of the story, and the 2 versions of the story would lead you to different outcomes as to whether the Chachamim were pleased with the behavior or not pleased with the behavior. Ela miha leka d'mashma mina. From that story, you can't conclude anything because each story or each version of the story would lead you to a different conclusion, whether we think what Yosef ben Yoezer did was correct or proper or was improper. My Havi'Allah, what is the conclusion to this? What is the answer? Do the Chachamim agree or disagree with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? Tashma, Damalei Shmuel the Rabbi Yehuda Shinina. So Shmuel said to his student, his Talmud Rabbi Yehuda, who's known as Rabbi Yehuda Shinina, in different places in Shas, Rashi interprets Shinina sometimes to mean someone who has long teeth, or other places to someone who is very erudite, very sharp, and he knows his stuff. So either it was a way to describe Rabbi Yehuda in their day many times, since they don't have surnames, the way that you describe the person, everybody has the same name, or a person with the same first name, you describe them by their appearance. Their appearance gives you an additional descriptor to know which Rabbi Yehuda you're speaking about. So that's one possibility, as to why it's describing his teeth. On the other hand, he was saying it about his student. The Shinina means the sharp one, is that he was his primary student, and we know that Rabbi Yehuda is a big Talmud of Rav and later of Shmuel, and quotes throughout Shas many members from Rav and Shmuel because of the fact that he was his student. Lo te'ave be avure achsanta. You should not be amongst those that move Yerusha around. Avil mi bra bisha le bra tavo. Even from a good child to a bad child. The kol shekein mi bra le brata. And certainly from a male child to a female child, you certainly should not move Yerusha. So in the first instance, you might be able to do it because of Yochanan ben Broka. You're allowed to reallocate the assets to your sons based on your wish or your will. That's what Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says. Over here, Shmuel says to Rabbi Yehuda, we are critical of those people that reallocate their assets to their children based on the deservedness of the child. You let the assets go to the children, irrespective of whether they're deserving or not deserving of those assets. And certainly, if you move it from a son to a daughter, where you're changing the Yerusha Doraita, you're avoiding the Yerusha Doraita, that's certainly improper. Now the reason being, and we'll see in a second, has to do with that if sometimes a child who's not appropriate will have a grandchild who is appropriate. But what the Gemara calls in Brachot with regards to Chizkel Melech, B'chadi Kavshu D'Rachman Olam Alach. You can't predict the future. You can't tell what's going to happen. Why are you getting involved in God's plans? So you shouldn't be intervening or interfering in God's plans. And given that, you should not reallocate assets based on who's good or who's bad, because you have no idea what the next generation will bring. The one who you think is good might have children who are bad, and the one who's bad might have children that are good. And therefore, your allocation is improper because you might actually cause the opposite of what you think to happen. And therefore, you should let the Yerusha fall and not redistribute it based on the behavior of the individuals. And certainly, you shouldn't redistribute from sons to daughters, which would be then an upending or undermining of Yerusha De'oraita. And this is where the Rashbam says that here the halacha is like the Rabbanan, despite the fact that normally the halacha is like Moshe ben Gamliel in the Mishnah, because here Shmuel says the Chachamim argue on Moshe ben Gamliel, and he says the halacha is like the Chachamim. So the fact that Shmuel explicitly says the halacha is like the Chachamim over here means that we upend or undermine the normal principle that Rabbi Yochanan says that halacha is like Moshe ben Gamliel b'mishnatenu. All right. Fazabi are 5 lines from the bottom of Kuf Lamed Gimel Amud Bet, because the next story continues almost through the entire Amud tomorrow.